This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, WTAN 1340. It's a perfect place for writers. It's always fun to hear from my guests, and especially when they have some wonderful news. Last month, I had David Edmonds, the author of Lily of Peru, on, and he just sent me a emails telling me about a fantastic prize that he won. He was voted, Lily of Peru was voted second place winner of the Latino Books into Movies Award. Now, when I read David's book, I envisioned it as a movie. It is beautifully written, and it's an exciting thriller set in Peru, where David was in the Peace Corps a number of years ago. And so he has turned his story into one that is really fascinating. I hope that you'll get his book. It's available on Amazon. And I look forward to seeing David's Lily of Peru at the movies. So congratulations, David. You know, it's always difficult to be a writer. It has its ups and downs and can play havoc with a person's ego, especially when our work is rejected. So I'm happy that today I will get to speak to someone who knows how to deal with unhappiness and feelings of rejection. And it is Patricia Knoll. She's in the studio with me. Hi, Patricia.
Hi there. How are you?
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to talking to you about your book, Good With Me, A Simple Approach to Happiness from Inside Out. It's an inspirational book that has been a guide for many people on how to improve their lives. And so at the bottom of the hour, we'll be talking to Patricia Moore about her book. Meanwhile, I have a guest on the radio from New York. Elizabeth George is a woman who should be very happy. And she's an international New York Times bestselling author. And I don't think she's been rejected for 30 years. So she has a pretty fantastic writing career. She's also the winner of the prestigious Agatha Award, which was named after, of course, the Queen of Mystery Writers, Agatha Christie. Not since Dorothy Sayers has a writer so cleverly combined crime fiction with brilliantly sophisticated writing. During the past three decades, her series of books, 19 so far, have centered around the charming and clever Inspector Thomas Lindley of Scotland Yard. Her books have become a BBC television series, and her newest book, A Banquet of Consequences, finds her in the top of her form as she unwinds a psychological mystery set amid a gorgeous portrait of England. So, hello, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm fine, and thanks for having me on the program.
Well, thank you. You know, before we talk about your newest Inspector Lindley book, Banquet of Consequences, which I think is going to be a great seller because it is certainly one of your best, and you have a wonderful storyline that makes this a very exciting book. I just want to mention one thing. The first three pages of one of your books has always stuck with me as being a prime example of the perfect opening for a mystery story, and that's In the Presence of the Enemy. Those first three pages, it's a classic, and I'm sure that in classes that teach writing, this should always be given to new writers to emulate, because it sets the tone, and it is so exciting, and it's so memorable that once you've read those three pages, you never forget them.
Well, thank you. You know, In the Presence of the Enemy has long been one of my favorite books, not only because of the twist in it, but also because it kind of leapt out of the starting box and never gave up the pace. So I thank you. I really appreciate that.
Well, it is. It's just a fantastic thing. Of course, your new book, A Banquet of Consequences, brings back, as always, this wonderful, wonderful group of characters that you have developed. And it's when I think about it, with your first book, going all the way back to your very first book, A Great Deliverance, which was actually your first book, right, that you published?
It was the first published book, yeah.
Yeah. And there you started with these characters, and over the years you have developed them in such an amazing way, and it's I wonder if you realized at the time you wrote them how full you would be able to make them over the years.
Well, of course not. I'm not sure anybody really in embarking upon a series has any knowledge of you know, whether the character's going to work or not, or how much wiggle room they've given themselves to work with the characters. But what I've discovered from having created characters with complicated backgrounds is that it's given me a tremendous amount of space to explore different aspects of their lives, which is what I've been doing for all this time since 1988.
Well, A Great Deliverance, you described Thomas Lindley, your main character, as educated at Eton, first in history at Oxford, public school voice, and a family, a bloody family tree that had its roots just this side of the Battle of Hastings. And, and being a golden boy, and how you describe him, and the charm and wit of that you developed in this first book has carried you through all of these years, and you just build on it so beautifully. And all, of all your characters, of course, you have five main characters in your book, books, right?
Yeah. I have five main characters and a whole slew of continuing minor characters too, and that in addition to the backgrounds of the characters has given me a tremendous canvas that I can work on.
Well, you have this juxtaposition of this very upper class British inspector, and then of course you have a wonderful character in Barbara Havers. Tell us about her.
Yeah. Well, Barbara Havers was a character that I created to be the partner of Lindley. When I began the series, my intention was that the forensic scientist St. James was going to be the main character, and the first two books that I wrote, which were never published, were books where St. James was the leading criminal investigator. But after those books did not see the light of publication, I decided to see if this character Lindley, who had also been part of the series, if he could handle a case on his own. In order to get him to handle a case on his own, I gave him a partner, and that was Detective Sergeant Barbara Havers. And she's a working class girl who is the polar opposite of Lindley. And indeed, in your description of Lindley that you gave earlier from A Great Deliverance, that's told from Barbara's point of view. And she is just learned that she's going to have to work with this man, and she absolutely hates him because not only because he's a member of the upper class, but because she sees only the superficial aspects of his character, which of course is those are the things that she's saying. The first in history, student at Eton, first in history at Oxford, and the family tree that went back to the Battle of Hastings. So, and those. Through her attitude, that is, just all to be mocked, and
part of that British class system that is
completely, and it's still that the class system in England is alive and well.
Oh, very.
So she is part of she's part of that working class with not a whole lot of hope of achieving greatness.
And then, of course, in the new book, where, of course, she is a main part of the new book, you have a very interesting dynamic between Lindley and Havers.
Yeah, because Barbara has placed herself into serious professional jeopardy in the previous book by not only giving information to a tabloid in an effort to manipulate her superior at New Scotland Yard, but she has also taken herself off to Italy without leave and inserting herself into an investigation. So she's in huge trouble at the end of that book, and her punishment is, rather than to just be fired, to be forced to fill in transfer papers, to request a transfer to Berwick-upon-Tweed, which is in the north of England. Of course, she doesn't want to be transferred there. Nobody would want to be transferred there. And her superior officer is holding this over her head like the sword of Damocles, you know, getting ready to lower it upon her if she steps out of line. So she's now in this position where she can't do anything wrong, or she knows that her career is finished, and that's where she is when the book opens.
Well, you know, you mentioned, of course, as I said, there are five main characters, and the character that you mentioned is the forensic scientist who has gone throughout your books, is perhaps one of my favorite characters. And I've always thought that, sort of like ink blots, you know, people can be judged sort of by which of your characters they like the most.
And, oh, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
I have always thought that Simon is such an interesting character. And he's always been my favorite of the characters. I think I related mostly to him because I love forensics. But tell me, where did you get the idea? You know, it's hard to know where you got the idea for all of these people. There are shades of course, Dorothy Sayers. Now you know, when I first read your books, I did not realize you were not British. I mean, the first time I read you, I said, well, you know, another British author. And I was amazed to find out that you're American, and that all of these, how you managed to capture England so perfectly. Because, like you had a fascination with England from a young age, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. I went to England first in 1966, and my fascination was initially triggered by the influx into America of all of these aspects of British pop culture that came over following the advent of the Beatles. And so I had been very, very interested in England for a while, and then had the opportunity in 1966 to go over for the first time. And that merely increased my interest in England and my love for the place.
But I know, of course, you lived in California, and you were a professor and a teacher of writing before you became a best-selling author. But it's so amazing because when I was young, it was always the British authors I turned to. I loved Agatha Christie, of course. That was, I think, my first, you know, series that I really fell in love with. I couldn't stop reading Agatha Christie, and of course then later on Dorothy Sayers. So when I was like 24 and I had saved up enough money, the first thing I did was buy a house in England.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
How cool. Where was it?
In Sonning, just out of Henley. And I bought a little cottage called St. Anne's Cottage on the High Street. And I had saved up my money. I'd been working very hard, and I saved money, and I had £19,000 and bought this little cottage. So you can see how close I am to England, and I lived there for quite a few years, you know, off and on. And I'm so sorry I ever sold that place. But
Oh, yeah.
So you know that I have the feel for England, and when I read your books, I'm just transported back there. Your use of language, and both the, as you say, you know, they're the classes of British class vocabularies are so different, and you manage to use them so perfectly. I'm always surprised. I have to sort of pinch myself. She's American, but she got this so perfectly.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. It's something that I certainly work at, knowing how, you know, for example, knowing how Lindley would express himself in a situation and how Havers would express herself in the exact same situation and how St. James, in that exact same situation, how he would express himself. So, that's part of the trick of carrying the book off in such a way that it seems like an authentic British novel.
Do you spend a lot of time in England when you're working on these, on your books?
I go over to do the location research if it's a book that's going to utilize one of the great institutions of England. Then that takes more time in doing research than it does if I'm just going to explore a town, for example, and try to get the details of the town right. To use an example, I wrote a book years ago called For the Sake of Elena that takes place at Cambridge University. Well, to understand the university system, I went to Cambridge on two summer sessions through UCLA and took an architecture course one summer and then took a Shakespeare course the next summer. And then I went back the following November to spend a week with a student in Cambridge. And so the combination of all of those things and plus interviewing professors and getting to go sit at the high table on a Sunday evening in the black gowns and all that the hoopla that's attendant to that, all that really allowed me to understand Cambridge. And it comprised about between 7 to 10 weeks altogether. But usually I don't require that much time if I am just doing a location. So I can do a location and get it with, get it down fairly well with a preliminary reconnaissance trip and then a longer trip where I am really, really doing some topographical gumshoeing to make sure that I can understand the layout, let's say, of a county in particular. Like the new book takes place in Dorset. So I spent 10 days in Dorset looking at all these different locations, and consequently all the locations that the reader sees in Dorset are all real places that I've been in, right down to the house that Alistair McCarran's lover lives in. I've been inside that house. It was exactly how I describe it, and that actually, allows me to give the books a verisimilitude that they wouldn't have if I was just, for example, depending on the internet for my resources.
Your depth of knowledge of England shows. Do they love you at Scotland Yard?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't be able to characterize how they feel about me, but they are. They've always been very nice in helping me out when I need to talk to somebody. I've discovered that about the police everywhere. For my new book, I spoke to the detective chief constable up in Shropshire, and he was really wonderful in giving me information about a really difficult situation they're facing with police cutbacks. And he was super helpful, and I've since, been in email contact with him asking more questions. And I found that in any profession up there, whether it's in England, whether it is the police or, somebody who runs a bakery, as is also the case in this new book, people are really, really willing to sort of explain their process and what's going on and how they're how it's affecting a greater organization, especially the police, and basically how they work. And it's just been great, very helpful.
Well, now, when you come to your, some of your stories, of course, are based on real cases you've heard about or not? Never or?
No, I wouldn't say they're based on that, but they take a leap off from that. So I used the terrible murder of James Bulger in up in North England to as the backstory in a book called This Body of Death. And what I really wanted to explore in This Body of Death was really two things. The first was my belief that, you know, when a 10-year-old boy or a group of 10-year-old boys kill a 2-year-old, you know, torture, kill him, and throw him on the railroad tracks, that's a crime that doesn't come out of nowhere. That's a crime that that indicates some serious psychopathology at the root in the background of the killers. And I wanted to explore that, and I also wanted to explore what happens to a 10-year-old killer when he finally gets out of prison as a young adult with a new identity. How does he remake his life? And how does that horrible, horrible crime that he committed, how does that affect his adult life and his way of interacting with other people? So you see, I wasn't really writing about the terrible thing that happened to the Bulger family, but what I was writing about was sort of inspired by that. And the question I asked myself as I read more and more about the case, the questions were, who were these kids? You know, what happened? How did they turn out like this? What is that? What's going on in their families? And that's what I wanted to look at.
Well, I mean, your books are famous for their really intricate plotting. That brings me around to a book that you wrote called Right Away, mm-hmm. One Novelist's Approach to Fiction. So tell us, when you're doing the research, well, first of all, what program do you use to write your books? What program are you using?
Do you mean
you type
computer program?
Yeah.
Oh, I just use Microsoft Word.
Uh-huh.
Basically, my computer is like a souped-up typewriter. That's all it is. On my writing computer, I don't do anything else. That's all it's used for is my writing. It's not connected to the internet. It's just plugged into an electrical socket. Basically.
That's it.
And I use Microsoft Word. Yeah.
And how do you plot your? How do you do your plotting? Do you do it? Do you do cards? Because your plotting is so intricate. You have so many different lines of plots and subplots within your books. How do you keep track of them? Are you a index card type of person? Do you write it out by hand? How do you do that?
In plotting the books, I always do the plotting scene by scene, and I don't plot out the whole book at once. I know who my point of view characters are before I begin the plot. I make the decision about where it is that this story is going to begin. Is it going to be before the beginning, at the beginning, or after the beginning? So I make that decision, and then having made that decision, I take 8 by 8.5 by 11 paper that I have a huge pile of scratch paper, and just cut that down to the size of like a mailing business envelope, and I begin putting a scene on each of those. For example, let's say that I know that I'm going to write a scene when Lindley gets the case, so I would write on the piece of scratch paper, Lindley gets called into Isabel Ardrey's office / gets the case. And so that then would be placed on the floor in my study underneath a piece of paper that has Lindley's name on it. And when I'm plotting out a book, the whole time I'm looking for causality, because one scene has to cause another scene to happen somewhere along the line. So if there isn't causality, then that scene really doesn't belong in the book. But the first scene, needs to cause some other scene to happen, not necessarily the very next scene. So what I do then is I've got all these point of view, I've got, let's say, 5 point of view characters laid out on my floor, and I plot as far as I can in causality. Usually only the first 10 scenes, or it might be the first 15 scenes. So then I take those papers and begin arranging them in the most logical formation, the most logical format for them to fall as scenes. So now I have these, let's say, 15 pieces of paper, all of which each one is the size of a business envelope, and I take that over to my desk then, and I create a document that's called the running plot outline. So I see this piece of paper. It says scene one, Lindley. So I know that that's going to be Lindley's point of view. And I then, what I do is I write about that scene in present tense, stream of consciousness, and I'm looking for a way into the scene. I start throwing things up on the screen of my computer until I feel the energy that tells me, okay, this is exactly how this scene should be molded. So then I mold the scene, and then I go on scene two and do the same thing, and that becomes the running plot outline through those first 10 or 15 scenes. And then I set that to one side and actually begin the process of writing the rough draft of the novel. So when I've gone through those first 15 scenes, writing the rough draft of the novel, I then go back and do the whole process again, and it becomes the second 15 scenes set up on my floor, and then et cetera, goes on from there.
So it takes you, what, about, well, you've done 19 books in 20 years or something like that?
30 years.
So it's a little, almost, a year and a half to write one of your books?
Exactly. That's about it, 18 months.
Yeah, about 18 months. Well, long gestation, but the birth is always wonderful. So when you advise writers, I know writers are always saying, you know, what should they do? Writing is such a... it's both an art and a craft. And so I always tell writers, you know, this program is called Joy on Paper, and I want writers to find the joy on paper, to just enjoy that process of getting the words down. And, you know, you have a idea, you have a something you want to say, but until you get the words down and learn how to craft them into something that is, you know, that people will enjoy reading, it's something one has to practice.
Right. But, and I also think it's really important for writers to develop a process. You know, in the book Right Away, that explains what my process is. And everybody has to develop a process. You can adopt other people's for a while and see what works for you. But until you have a process, you're in a position of just staring at the blank screen of the computer terminal and hoping something springs to mind. But for me, because I have a process, I've been able to go, you know, to go from book to book to book over a period of years, and I believe increasing the quality of the book each time because having a process allows me to concentrate on the writing itself. If you're just sitting at the computer facing a blank screen, the problem is you're always thinking, you know, what happens next? And you're thinking, what would this character do? But if the characters are created in advance and you have a running plot outline that you're referring to, that allows you to have the joy of writing, which is the manipulation of language, and that's the art part of it. So the craft is in the craft is in process. The art is in writing. But if you don't have a process, then you get the craft and the art mixed up, and you're trying to do both at the same time, and the craft gets in the way of the art, and it's really hard to, I believe, to turn out a really well-crafted novel, because you're getting everything jumbled up in your head. And for me, that would not work. I never would have written a book if I had not developed a process of how to do it.
Well, you certainly came out with a, as I said, the characters that you developed in the first book were so good that they could just carry through all of these books, and that's an unusual accomplishment. Most people can't, you know, maintain. Of course, the nice thing is they've aged, well, more or less, they've aged along with the process. Unlike, for example, Dorothy Sayers had a, Dorothy Sayers was it bad? Agatha Christie's character sort of stayed in one place in time.
Exactly. Yeah.
But your characters have developed with the aid, with the years.
Well, you know, and the reason is that, you know, Agatha Christie was writing a different kind of novel. She was writing a mystery novel, which is frequently just a lighthearted romp through murder. And basically, what a mystery novel does is it pits the writer against the reader by setting up a puzzle for the reader to try to solve before the writer reveals the truth. And so mystery novels are all about the puzzle. Crime novels are about the characters, and so they're two different things. So for in my situation, you know, if the reader figures out who the killer is, that's really no big deal. I mean, usually they don't, but if they do, it's not a big deal because there's always something that they don't know, and what they don't know is buried within the characters, and that's what the story reveals to them. In addition to revealing who the killer is, it reveals all along who these characters are, which is to me much more interesting as a reader and as a writer.
Well, and when I was thinking of Dorothy Sayers, In many ways, you know, of course, her character, Lord Peter Wimsey, has shades of Inspector Linley. And again, what's so wonderful in your books are literature. They're not just, you know, crime fiction. And I love how you are able to use language and vocabulary in such a fantastic way, whether it is sort of the common language of the British common people. All of this adds to the depth of your writing. And, of course, there's always new words in your books that even I have to look up, and it's I love it. But you use them so beautifully and use them so correctly. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
So you must have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, I do, and I'm always I always love running across a word in someone's work that I'm unfamiliar with and have to look up. I just think that's sort of part of it. That's part of the joy. If everything is, you know, so simple that the reader doesn't have any kind of challenges, then, you know,
exactly. Well, in Dorothy Sayers, you have to look up a few Latin phrases, and you have to look up a little bit of French, and it makes it.
Oh my God! There's one Dorothy Sayers book where she does this letter in French, and she never translates it.
I know.
So if you want to know what it says, you better translate the French.
I couldn't do it. I finally had to get. It was too difficult. And finally had to get somebody to do it for me. But I loved it. It was just a wonderful thing. You know, I thought, well, what respect she was showing for the reader.
Yeah, and it's like only Peter Wimsey would propose to Harriet Vane in Latin and have her respond in Latin. I mean, it's just great. If you didn't know Latin, you don't know exactly what she said. I mean, you can figure it out, but it's so fun that's how it was done.
Well, I think it shows, as in your books, a respect for the reader's intelligence, that they're intelligent enough to get it, and I like that.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. It's a, you know. It's having confidence in the reader, that the reader is going to understand either the action implies the translation, or from the ensuing dialogue, you're able to understand what it was said, even if it was said in a foreign language.
Well, I know you live, of course, in the state of Washington, and not in England, but, of course, luckily in Washington, you get enough of British-style weather. Put you in the mood?
Definitely.
So I remember one time when I was living in England, we had like 6 months of rain, 6 months. So you get that out where you are sometimes, right? Almost every day.
Well, it can be rainy. We certainly had a glorious summer this year. It's not so much the rain in Washington that I mean, people do think it rains a lot, and in some areas like Forks, it certainly rains a great deal. But the big thing in Washington is that you have to have a high tolerance for gray because there's a great it's much more overcast than most places are.
Well, that'll put you in the mood for England most of the time. Well, it's been just wonderful talking to you. Of course, for my listeners, I want to encourage them all to go and get Elizabeth George's new book, which I'm sure will be a New York Times bestseller, A Banquet of Consequences. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and in bookstores everywhere. And Elizabeth, I just want to thank you so much for being with me today. I was thrilled to be able to talk to you. Your books are fantastic, and I know that my listeners will really enjoy the new book.
Thanks so much, Patsy.
Okay. Take care. Have a great book tour.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
Tuesday on the Rocket Sports and Entertainment Network show, we will talk football. Final Four, week two of the college football playoff polls are out. Is Clemson going to stay at number one? Alabama fresh off their home victory over LSU. Will they jump? We'll talk about the laugher of a Monday night football game between the San Diego Chargers and the Chicago Bears, and much, much more. Afternoons 2 to 4 on the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my next guest, Dr. Patricia Ngo, who is a licensed mental health counselor and self-esteem expert. Hi, Patricia.
Hi again.
Okay. Okay. Well, as I was saying, Elizabeth George is a great success, and her last rejection, I think, was 30 years ago. With writers, of course, they face a lot of rejection, and everybody faces rejection. So your book, which is really fascinating, is called Good With Me, A Simple Approach to Happiness from the Inside Out.
Yes.
And tell us about it. Well, tell us first a little bit about happiness. How do we find happiness?
Well, we have to know what it is, first of all. Before we can find it, we have to really know what it is. And most of us have been taught that happiness is in having the next new car or the right boyfriend or girlfriend or the right this or the right degree, or the list could be endless, because that's where we keep looking for happiness. And happiness is something that's really inside of us, and it comes from the way that we think, not from what we have or do or are or know.
Well, a big part of your book is talking about self-esteem.
That's right.
And how do we get self-esteem if we don't have it? that's a problem with some people. They're not sure of themselves. They're not positive in their attitude. So.
Right, because first of all, let me just explain a little bit here, back up. We as a society are teaching what I have discovered to be other-dependent esteem. And we think that's self-esteem, and it really isn't. It doesn't have anything to do with self. So we keep wondering why so many of us have so little happiness. And have you ever noticed, Patsy, when we do have a little happiness, maybe because we have the new car or the new this or we did that or something else, that it's so short-lived, it doesn't last even when we do get it? And so, yeah, we have moments of happiness, but it's all other dependent. It's dependent upon someone or something outside of us. And so real happiness, and how do we get it, is changing the way we think. We have to learn how to actually reprogram our brain, retrain our brain to think positive thoughts, happy thoughts, as opposed to, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening, and that was awful, and that was terrible, and I'm all messed up, and I can't believe that, you know, I'm doing what I'm doing, and maybe people won't like me. And
well, I found your book fascinating, and you have all these little areas of questions where you encourage the reader to write down or to question their motivation in different things, their attitude about different subjects. I think that's a very useful part of your book. I think it's fantastic.
Yes, it's exploration and discovery. It's exploring who am I? How do I think? How did I get here? And now how can I shift and make that change?
Now, I know you're an expert in addictive behavior.
Yes.
And Deepak Chopra has complimented you on one of your projects. What is that project?
My treatment manual that I wrote for my outpatient treatment program called Focus One. And I wrote a manual for people to follow along and do some homework with. And he took a look at it and endorsed it.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yes.
That's a great endorsement.
I'm very honored.
Well, you have to be. So sort of people are also addicted to not feeling happy. I mean, they're sort of like you, it just becomes a habit not to be happy.
Absolutely. And so that's such a great point that you bring up, Patsy, because when we are happy, it feels uncomfortable. Because we're so used to being unhappy. And, you know, anything that becomes familiar, unhappiness or happiness, becomes comfortable. Even pain, once we're familiar with whether emotional or physical, that pain becomes comfortable.
So how do you start off? What's the first step in this new approach to that you have for finding happiness?
Good question. I say it's identify the fact that you are actually thinking. Most people are going through life on autopilot, and they're not aware that they're the ones responsible for all that chatter up there in their heads, right? And so just not even questioning, not even noticing, how did it get there? What is it? Who's making that chatter? Who's creating it? So we have to become aware, first of all, that we are actually thinking, that we're creating those thoughts rather than living life on autopilot, kind of going through life sleepwalking.
So when you're talking about exploration and discovery, how should people approach it? Should people actually just take a day, you know, like a time, quiet time, you know, instead of, you know, having been surrounded with all the electronic things and all, just to think.
Yes, absolutely. You know, how much time do we really spend on taking care of ourselves, say physically? We, you know, exercise and do all kinds of things, but we spend so little time on taking care of ourselves emotionally and mentally, and getting quiet and saying, who am I really? We just don't even know most of the time.
So do you do a lot of work with people in groups?
Yes.
And that's sort of how your book developed from the work that you have done with people over the years?
That's right. I've worked with thousands and thousands of people over the past 26 years now that I've been doing this. And it's been very interesting because some of them have come to me involuntarily through the court system, and others have come to me on their own voluntarily. And the thing that became so interesting to me, Patsy, was some people would get better for a while, and then they would kind of relapse back into the old behaviors. And other people would do better than that. But I just kept questioning, what am I missing? What's going on here? And what I discovered was this common thread that was running through everyone. And that was the lack of real self-dependent esteem. And when I say that, I mean the kind of esteem that comes from the inside out. It comes from inside of me. It means that I like me and I feel good about me just because I'm alive and I exist, and not because of what I have, what I do, who I know, and all of those things.
And this other esteem, that you talk about two esteems. What's the other esteem?
Yes, I do. The other esteem is other dependent esteem. And that's what we're teaching as professionals, as a society. We're teaching that we're as good as our stuff. you know, we're as good as who we know, what we know. Did we get the right degree from the right school? Did we write the right book? We're talking about authors and writers. Did we write good copy? What do we have? Who do we know? Do we wear designer clothes? Do we have the best cars? We've been taught that that's what's supposed to make us feel good about ourselves or our accomplishments. And so there really isn't anything really self about that. That's all external. And what happens if we lose it? We have nothing left. And we oftentimes see people who have lost everything, and what do? They jump out of high-rise buildings or off of the Skyway Bridge, or that's the severe extreme of it, or they just maybe want to just curl up in a ball and stay under the covers for the day or something like that.
So it sounds good, but how actually do you do it? I mean, how do you find this inner, almost an inner glow that you need, right?
Okay. So I gave you the first step was to realize that you're actually thinking. The second step then is to identify, what am I thinking? So the what is, am I thinking, you know, positive thoughts all the time about myself? Or am I like over 90% of our society who's been taught to think negative thoughts about ourselves? You know, we're always comparing ourselves to others. For example, there's some research done on young girls, adolescent and teenage girls, and the more they watch television, the worse they feel about themselves. So it's that comparing ourselves to other people. And if you pay attention, when we aren't feeling good about ourselves and we don't have real self-esteem, we aren't going to pick someone that we think is a little bit less than we are to compare ourselves to. We're going to compare ourselves to maybe the celebrities, the person that's doing what we want to be doing, and then what we see ourselves kind of coming in on the short end of the stick.
Well, how can you build your self-esteem if you say you don't have a lot of it?
Right.
Is there a process where if you like do good things, if you help others, does that come into it?
That doesn't really, because
no,
that's all external,
that's
right?
That's external.
So
how do you do it for yourself?
I have to know that I have value because I exist for no other reason. So what does that mean? I have to change the way I think about myself. I have to see myself with softer eyes. I have to see that I am a kind person. I am good just because. And that's the hard part. That is totally the hard part, Patsy.
It does.
Because we're looking for this magic potion,
yeah.
And right?
It would be so much nicer if you just, you know, could just like, okay, I'm going to do something good today. So that's
right. It's about seeing ourselves the way we are. You know, I always say warts and all. And loving that about ourselves, instead of looking at the warts and you know, when if we have a mole on the face, all we see is the mole. We never see the rest of our face. So it's about seeing that mole on our face and loving that too and embracing that and saying, you know, I am perfectly beautiful the way I am. I like who I am. I don't have to be anything more or anything different. I can accept me for who I am right now at this particular moment in time. It's, excuse me, it's kind of the Tuesdays with Maury philosophy, mm-hmm. the fabulous book, Tuesdays with Maury. And, you know, he talked about when we're at a certain stage in life to be there and to enjoy that and to like that and to love that and to cherish that. And that's what we have to do with ourselves. No matter where we are and what we're doing at this particular moment in time, we are good enough, just the way we are right now. And that means changing our thinking, because the thought is going to pop in there and say, oh, who are you trying to kid? You know, and then we're also told so often by professionals, fake it till you make it. Well, you know, I faked it for most of my life, Patsy, and I didn't make it by faking it. I had to change the way I saw myself and the way I thought about me so that I could enjoy me just the way I was. I wasn't everything that I thought, you know, I was supposed to be, but I enjoyed it and I started to embrace it.
Well, you're like a plastic surgeon's worst nightmare because so many people, especially, I mean, men and women today, they need plastic surgery to make themselves feel better. You know, it's a
right.
It's a, such a common thing now. But you're saying just love yourself the way you are.
Mm-hmm. In fact, who says what beautiful is? Who defined beauty? And who says that we have to be a particular way in order to be beautiful? Where did we buy into that? And how did we do that?
That's a great question. Wonderful. And so that we can find some of the answers in your book.
That's right.
And it's called Good With Me by Dr. Patricia Noel. And it's based on all of your work that you've done over the years. And I know that I've heard some testimonials and read some of the things that you've done. And you've been a great success. So how do people get your book? Do you have a website?
I do have a website. It's goodwithme.com. Mm-hmm. Very simple and easy to get to. I offer autographed books there along with the Good With Me pen. And there are T-shirts that say Good With Me and lots of fun stuff.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Things to encourage you to feel good about yourself and whether... No matter what you do in life, that's what you need. You need self-esteem so that you can face the journey, I guess.
Right, right. And that's just feeling good about ourselves. And it just is so opposing to everything that we've been taught about self-esteem, because what we've been taught doesn't work.
Well, I encourage my listeners to get the book, to work through some of these little areas where she has a work sort of like worksheets, because it really is an exploration and discovery of yourself, and I think it will be very helpful. I'm looking forward to doing it myself. Okay, what have you jeopardized in order to fit in? Well, so I love these questions. You have some wonderful questions in here. What have you been willing to risk just to fit in? All of these and so many more questions are in your book, and I think it's a fantastic book. It's also available, of course, on your website and at Amazon. And it's a kind of book that when you get it, you're going to want to keep it, and I believe you're going to want to share it.
Yes.
Because there's so much in here that really touches the heart with your stories and touches the mind of what's possible if you just work at it a little bit.
Yes, and what's interesting, Patsy, and you hit on it there, is that once an individual starts to see the difference in their own lives because of it, they want the people that they love and care about to experience
share.
The same
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. As soon as I read this book, I said, oh, I want to share this book.
Absolutely.
So it's fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me today. I wish we had more time. And what I would like to do, actually, I'm going to give this book out to a few people. And when I get their reaction and when I have their input, perhaps next spring you'd come back. I'm going to be having some more time for you. I'll be able to give you a lengthier time so that you can actually maybe work through some of these.
I'd love to.
And I might actually bring a few people into the studio with us.
Wonderful.
So that they can ask you from their personal perspective what they found in your book and how it helped them and your suggestions for them. So
perfect.
Okay?
Very good.
So it was
I'll look forward
so
to
nice
it.
Of you to join me today.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And this is Patsy with a Z. Okay, and I just want to thank everyone for joining me today. And please make sure that you join me next Tuesday. I have an exciting guest next Tuesday. And thank Big Ed in the control room. Remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. So join me next week, Tuesday at 11 a.m. for Joy on Paper. Meanwhile, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy. Treasure it and share it. Have a great week.